a lot of members that, you know, they think of Bitcoin and Fartcoin as like just different names for the same thing, right? So we're in this like interesting world where the United States is sort of signaling to the rest of the world that it thinks about Bitcoin as digital gold and a strategic asset and wants to build a reserve of it. And yet a large number of staffers and congressmen and senators, you know, they're on like sort of step one, right, in a lot of their knowledge. So you kind of, while you have like the sort of grad school level stuff that I've been talking about, right, you also need to kind of do like the 101 level stuff at the same time. And that's basically BPI's function, right? Is to kind of do both, right? To try to just do like the policymaker education and kind of lay the foundation, as well as try to like advance the frontier. Like where can this really be executed? And what's the strategic implications of this? Others might make the argument that the government's balance sheet hasn't changed, right? It just marked an existing illiquid intangible asset into a liquid asset, converted that into dollars, and they converted the dollars into Bitcoin. And the government's overall net position didn't change, right? It just took an existing liquid asset, monetized it, and bought Bitcoin with it. And so I think this is less like a legal question and more of like a question of like how different levels of the bureaucracies are going to interpret what budget neutral means. And then ultimately, it's like how you argue it. So I think about budget neutral really in terms of the incremental net cost to the taxpayer. And in terms of what are the mechanisms at the end of the day, does the taxpayer have to foot a further bill to finance these Bitcoin purchases? That's really where the rubber meets the road for me. On what that executive order really means. If you asked folks even a few weeks ago whether an SBR was plausible or even like, you know, 10% likelihood of getting in passed in law by August, I think people would have faded that, right? Like 1% chance or less. I wouldn't say it's like above 50%, right, by any means, but I think it's climbing, right? You're seeing more co-sponsors come on to the Lummis bill. You've seen Nicholas Begich, who is an absolutely boss Bitcoiner from Alaska that every Bitcoiner should follow. He actually had like coins at Mt. Gox. That's how OG this guy is. And he's a software developer. He's a super, super nice guy. And he decided to take the bull by the horns and introduce a companion bill, essentially emulating the Bitcoin Act in the House. And then immediately got a whole bunch of co-sponsors. And so now it's a thing, right? When you have a bill that starts getting co-sponsors, right? You start getting momentum, you start getting, this isn't just like one senator's sort of pet project. It's now got legs and you got to build momentum. And then you got to get the White House to provide public support for that. And then we'll see, right?
Matt, how's it going?
Yo, well, man, it's been a wild few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you from what you told me at the start of the show, what was it, 6 weeks for the Bitcoin for America Summit to go from idea to an actual event that had several congressmen, congresswomen, and senators?
Yeah, it was a feat, man. It was a feat of just logistics, coordination, spinning hundreds of different plates. Really proud of the full BPI team. That basically, once we made the sort of go decision, we kind of had to go all in and go 1,000 miles an hour. Essentially plan a full conference that we normally spend, you know, 4 to 6 months sort of deliberately planning, doing that in, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. So, and obviously, you know, before we started planning it, we didn't know that the White House was going to convene a crypto summit. We didn't know that there was going to be that executive order signed. And so that all happened and was evolving like at the last week, right, as we were ramping up for our event. So it turned out to almost be ideal timing. But of course, we had to do some last minute, you know, pivots and adjustments given the developments the week prior to the event. So certainly a high wire act, but extremely proud of the BPI team that pulled it all together. And I think it was one of the most successful events not just BPI's done, just like in my sort of experience with Bitcoin sort of events, this seemed to be among the more important. And maybe that's not just me talking about a book because I'm now executive director of BPI. But I do think it was among the more significant gatherings. And to have that come together in a relatively short period of time was a real sort of plaudit for the folks at BPI.
100%. Yeah, nothing short of amazing because, you know, I remember last year, I went to the policy summit, saw you, saw Zell, saw Grant. And, you know, I remember that being advertised like, you know, 2 months in advance. And then all of a sudden, this kind of showed up on my radar. And I'm like, whoa, this seems new. And the timing for it, honestly, you know, I don't know what drove the idea initially, but frankly, the timing for it was pretty superb because 3 days prior, you know, we had this, right? We had the executive order. Let me look at the number, 14233, the establishment of the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve and United States Digital Asset Stockpile. I want you to walk me through this, not just what the bill contains, but also the significance. We've spoken, you and I in the past, and also you've tweeted in the past. I know we spoke last year. You talked about like the easiest way to get an SBR would be basically just saying, all right, the 200,000 we already have, that's the SBR, right? For now, right? That's kind of the proto SBR, and we'll go from there. In essence, it's what we got, but we also got a little bit more. We got two big things. We got the separation of Bitcoin and crypto, or Bitcoin and digital assets, in the nomenclature of the bill itself, in the title of the bill. They're being treated differently. And also, we got this budget neutral phrase that's flying around. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are confused by that. I know you've done some tweeting about it. So walk me through the bill and some of the stuff that sticks out to you.
Yes, and a lot has happened relatively quickly, so I can understand why folks are sort of having a bit of a whiplash. Because if you were even paying attention closely to the talk around a Bitcoin reserve over the past few months, let alone the last few weeks, you know, your predictions would have to be widely updated almost on a week-to-week, if not, you know, day-to-day basis. And what originally motivated this this forum, Bitcoin for America forum, was a perception of a kind of a gap between these sort of behind closed doors conversations and sort of implicit preferences of a wide range of industry stakeholders and sort of senior officials that it's a good idea to prioritize a strategic Bitcoin reserve. But when it came to like the on the ground policy discussions and movement inside DC and the relevant committees, that wasn't matching. And so the original idea for the forum was to just bring together the whole sort of as much industry leaders and thought leaders and executives together with politicians to sort of make that implicit understanding more explicit and to sort of try to jumpstart essentially the political organization and momentum around a strategic Bitcoin reserve to kind of catalyze some action. And that objective was sort of rendered a bit moot by the Thursday night executive order. Although, you know, who knows, right, what was happening in the meantime as we were trying to organize this activity. So then we kind of pivoted to, okay, then what, right? Now that we've made this explicit declaration, as you rightly pointed out, of essentially like a Bitcoin maximalist, effectively, if you read between the lines, it's essentially saying we're only going to hold Bitcoin really for the long term. We're never going to sell it. We still stand to potentially sell the crypto asset stockpile. Mm-hmm. And made a very clear justification for holding Bitcoin as digital gold, and that there is a strategic value for the United States in holding digital gold, Bitcoin specifically. And so I think that was a bit of a 180 from the sort of the, I'd say, the prevailing perception of the Sunday morning tweets about a crypto stockpile.
Yeah, he name dropped specifically,
yes,
a bunch of things that you and I both know to be largely of little to zero value and associated with known scammers. And then all of a sudden, less than a week later, we get such a... So a brief detour, why on earth did he tweet that? And then what was... Why between then and Thursday? Do you think his team got to him and said, look, this is what we are planning. You know, you should walk these statements back, or just so you know, this is what we're planning. To me, it seems like the people who had made these huge donations to him in the campaign had spoken to him about this tweet, and then Lutnick and Co. basically said, hey, this is what we're planning.
Yeah, I mean, every White House has a policy process, and then there's a communications process, right? And sometimes those don't necessarily, fully match up, right? And there can be, you know, one-off events like this where the communications channels result in the release of what to maybe the comms people seems like a rhetorical declaration, but for the policy people is a very significant announcement. And I think there is a recognition that the communications release did not match up with what had been going on the policy front. And so there had to be a realignment of that in earnest from Sunday to Thursday, and I think that's what occurred. And I think what you saw on Thursday was the true expression of the policy organization and activities underway, where the executive order, clearly they had lawyers looking at that for several weeks. They clearly had, well thought through arguments in terms of how they would want to structure, the front matter and then the specific taskers to Commerce and Lutnick and Bessent at Treasury to identify, quote, budget neutral means of acquiring additional Bitcoin on top of the assets currently held once those are, fully accounted for through a comprehensive audit and build America's Bitcoin position in a way that doesn't add incremental marginal cost to the taxpayer. So that's where we are now. And so it's really kind of a dramatic shift, and I think in expectations on one, the degree of intentionality and seriousness and prioritization of Bitcoin and separation of Bitcoin relative to other digital assets in terms of the strategic relevance for the United States and how it intends to build that position and provide, political oomph to the bureaucracy to set up such a reserve and then also to potentially support congressional action to codify it in law. So I think if folks 6 months ago, 3 months ago, maybe even, a month ago, your baseline expectation of the future for that type of policy would have been very different than what it is now. And so this is a, a very dramatic policy shift, right? And I've seen it up close, seen how it's evolved in real time. And I'm not sure most folks have fully updated themselves to the degree to which this is a very real and very serious policy shift. And it is now waterfalling through the bureaucracies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems so. And this is, the best case scenario for people who can recognize the value of Bitcoin relative to all of the, other sort of affinity assets out there. This is the best case scenario. One of the things that you tweeted, and then I want to talk about budget neutral, and also congrats on, everything you've done. And, in your own way, being a huge help in making this happen. There haven't been a lot of people in DC on the policy front working to distinguish these things and talk about real Bitcoin policy. But you have, and you guys have over at BPI. So congratulations on that. And really well done because it really has shaped the future of America. One thing you tweeted back in July was something like, I don't, or maybe it was July or November. I think it was around when Trump got announced as a speaker. You said, I don't think enough people, enough, I think you said serious macro analysts understand the implications of a Trump admin for Bitcoin, and its geopolitical importance, right? Something like that. The price action we've seen since the announcement of an SBR has been that, right? We fell all the way down to 77. Obviously, a typical sell the news event, but for me, and I wrote about this and I'm going to publish it later today, is for an event of this magnitude, it seems that even if something like this was priced in, why on earth would it be a sell the news event, right? The long-term geopolitical implications of the United States, the world's, foremost economic superpower buying Bitcoin, it seems like that's more than, ah, oh, it happened. I'm going to sell Bitcoin now. It seems like that's something everyone would want to be front-running. And that would drive price up and not down. So, you were right to think a lot of people weren't thinking about this correctly. It's a little bit strange because Bitcoin is a high information market, so this kind of mispricing doesn't happen normally. How do you think about this? How do you think about the long-term implications of this?
Well, it's funny you say high information market. I'm not sure I would agree with that statement in the sense that, I was as close to this thing as most people were, and I didn't have a good sense of what was really going to happen here. Like a very small number of people really did, and even the language in the EO, I think people didn't. people don't really read things very closely, right? Right. Like the initial reaction was, "Oh, they're just going to hold their coins. They're not really going to buy new ones." And then
It
even
felt like they control left the document for the word buy and they couldn't find it,
Yeah,
so
and
they
even if
sold.
you read the relevant portions, depending on how you read, various tea leaves in DC, you might interpret that as a bureaucratic stall, a kind of a way of kind of punting it. And so it's a matter of how you understand like the intentionality behind those words, right? And then I think you have to take into account, I'm not a macro think boy, but the overall equity market and most risk assets have been getting pummeled by overall trade policy uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty. And, you know, you look at cross-border capital, he looked at, you know, his liquidity measures, which, you know, on a certain, you know, sort of trailing basis, directly correlate to Bitcoin's relative short-term price movements, right? So I think you have a contraction of liquidity more broadly, and that's, you know, Bitcoin is a highly sensitive liquidity barometer. So you have like two different sorts of dynamics affecting the Bitcoin spot price on any given day. One is like people's discounted future of the value of Bitcoin as an emerging global reserve asset. And then there's the traders, right, which set the basic clearing price, you know, minute to minute, who are looking at contracting balance sheets, trade policy uncertainty, and algorithmic trading rules that are basically just treating Bitcoin as a levered sort of triple Q, essentially. And that is, those are like, you know, one is a high frequency, sort of driver. The other is like a structural driver, right? And, you know, sources of liquidity in the market come from both perspectives. And I think really, like, if you were in those rooms in the last week, you would radically reprice your sense of the future value of Bitcoin, given like the left tail of the risk distribution has basically been chopped off, and the right tail in terms of sovereign adoption being accelerated has now dramatically expanded, right? But it takes time for those people to like press buy or to like think about how they want to buy in a market, right, where they want to acquire large positions and where they're also trying to hedge themselves against the other drivers, right, which is the macro environment and the liquidity conditions. And then the other kind of maybe third, more less discussed variable, which is the U.S. government intends to acquire more Bitcoin. It has every incentive to ensure that it gets the best value for those purchases. So it has no real objective, has no benefit to try to pump the price of Bitcoin before it can acquire a meaningful position, right? So unlike with a, you know, institution, usually like a normal big institution, whether it's BlackRock or whatever, like, everyone's kind of assumed that whenever they get to the point of announcing like a shift in their Bitcoin investment stance, everyone just assumes that they've already acquired the position that they want, right? Because of course nobody wants the market to like run ahead of their buys given the announcement. In a democracy, right? Unfortunately, right? Well, in this case, but I think it's a good thing that we have democracy that has to be accountable and transparent. They kind of have to telegraph what they're going to do, right? But they kind of have to do it in as the most ambiguous way possible, right? While providing sort of that parenthesis of ambiguity that at least buys them time to acquire a meaningful position. So this is, you know, I think people, it's funny, Bitcoiners are like famously long time preference, right? But then of course they're just social media addicts who just want to see number go up, right? Like on a headline announcement.
Yeah.
And I just think folks are dramatically underpricing the strategic and structural change that was put in place last Friday. Now it's not without uncertainty, right? Like there's lots of things that still could sort of click into different directions along that path. But it was a dramatic shift. And the things that I was paying attention to from that Thursday night to the forum that we had and then discussions afterwards, I was just incrementally increasing dramatically my assessment of how serious the government is and making good on this pro-Bitcoin policy. But the one caveat to that maybe more bullish long-term structural proposition is this is a government, right? This is a bureaucracy. These are sets of bureaucracies, the Treasury Department, the Commerce, and a lot of these folks just got into their jobs. And I think David Sacks, the AI and crypto czar, has given news interviews where he's talked about how the White House is moving at, quote, tech speed, right? And that's the White House moving at tech speed, right? And they're trying to get these departments to catch up to that tech speed. But most departments, agencies do not operate at tech speed, right? They operate at memo speed and study speed and different bureaucratic fiefdoms trying to maintain their own rice bowls. And so... when you have something like a novel policy, like a strategic Bitcoin reserve, right, that gets established by an executive order, now you're in this brass tacks mode of like, okay, well, as the executive order says, it should be managed by an office. Well, like which office? Is there a new office that needs to be created? And like an office is like a bureaucratic entity. It has to be established. And that might come at the cost of an existing office. So, like, which new senior executive positions are going to be created to staff that, if any? Or does the office just remain in quote marks, right? And then what legal opinions need to be created inside these departments to provide kind of the internal reference point and the standard operating procedures and questions about, okay, doing the audits and the custody. Like, these are the devils in the details things that, you know, pieces of paper have to be created. You know, memos have to be written. Legal opinions have to be drafted and vetted. And then, senior leaders have to sign off on these things. And each of these is like a, you know, multi-week process, right? And somewhat opaque, even to the people at the top of these agencies, right? And this is now the game that we're in now, right? As the White House has now adopted this pro-Bitcoin policy stance and then directed the rest of the federal government to take these actions, now we're in that period where, like, you know, the captain of the cruise ship has said, oh, we need to turn the boat, right? And then they gives the instructions to the first mate, and the first mate gives instructions to the engine room. Mm. And it's like, there's a whole cascade of these things. And then before the wheel starts turning, and then you turn the wheel, but it's a big boat, right? And it takes a while. You might see only an incremental change. But once that change is set in motion, like, the boat's going in a different direction, right? And I think that's where we are now. Like, we saw the captain issue the orders, and everyone's looking at the boat, and the boat's basically barely moved, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's just maybe you need to, like, restructure your understanding of how this is going to play out.
Very well said. Yeah, I like the cruise ship analogy. I hadn't heard that before. You're phenomenal with analogies, by the way. Very well said. And you're right. You know, the Bitcoin ethos is purportedly low time preference. But then you take a look at Bitcoin's price action. Numbers not going up. You can't find the word buy on the EO. You know, people throw a temper tantrum, right? All of a sudden, they're five-year-olds again. And Bitcoin, we do forget, in times like this, when there are a huge number of Bitcoin native factors that are letting it outperform to a certain degree, at least over January and February, we sometimes forget that this thing is traded, you know, 95% of the liquidity in the market as, like, levered QQQ, like you said. And while it may have outperformed in January and February, kind of in the lead up to this EO, it didn't fall when, you know, Global M2 and Michael Howell's measure of liquidity and our measure of liquidity at TBL were falling. Now it is. Now it's snapping back to reality, right? Those Bitcoin native factors, you know, have all come to the fore. We get the most bullish, you know, thing out of Washington, you know, a pro Bitcoin U.S. government. And now it's time for Bitcoin's price to correct back down to reality, right? The beautiful thing is that on that 70-day, 50-day delay, Global M2 is now inflecting higher. And so brighter shores, you know, are ahead for Bitcoin and probably the rest of risk, ideally, right? You know, barring further tariff geopolitical shenanigans, because it is Trump's MO to create chaos and then introduce stability. That said, one of the things you had mentioned on Twitter, David Bailey tweeted out the U.S. government holds a lot more Bitcoin than is publicly known about, with agencies outside of U.S. Marshals. I don't think anyone has a holistic picture. Interesting wrinkle. You quote tweeted it and said a lot more. And then Andrew Bailey tweeted that a month ago or 2 months ago, you had said a good step would be to issue an executive order that instructs the federal government to conduct an inventory of their digital asset holdings. That's exactly what David Sacks did. Congratulations. He is stalking your Twitter account. But that said, why is it so important to conduct an audit first? You gave the cruise ship analogy. To me, that makes sense. You said we have a lot more. What makes you say that?
Well, I'll say at that time, I thought we had a lot more. There might be other reasons why we might have lost some of it. You know, the government's current Bitcoin position, right, is made up of the public position is made up of, you know, asset seizures, right? That's most of what is referred to when people talk about U.S. government holdings of Bitcoin. The U.S. government, right, in its intelligence and law enforcement capacities, has long used crypto as both the means of payment for you know, covert operations or covert sources, especially in, like, cyber operations, right, where that's, like, the coin of the realm. So if you're going to conduct, you know, honeypot operation, or you want to disrupt those networks, you're going to be, you know, using the coin of that realm, which is crypto. And 10 years ago or more, right, like, what was, like, a relatively low marginal kind of operational budget for such an activity, you know, could have been a few thousand Bitcoin, right? And if those were just sort of kept there, right, in various operational accounts, right, that is now a material amount of money, right, that is not necessarily accounted for in the bucket that we think about the U.S. Marshals Service, right? And it's my understanding that that pool of potential digital assets that is held across the intelligence community and other parts of law enforcement is very large, or was very large. Now, one, possibility is that once this executive order was starting to be drafted or potentially be drafted, like, could those have been sold, right? If the executive order basically says you're have to identify and then transmit those assets to a central reserve, it's kind of less useful for you. You get to lose that. So maybe they had incentive to sell. And so this could be a compounding effect of like the government saying, is the government is not a monolith, right? And sometimes like bureaucrats, they respond to their own personal incentives. Not saying there's anything illegal done about that, right? It's technically it was within the letter of the law by the executive order because it set this deadline, right? So whatever digital assets, still exist by that deadline have to be identified. But and then if we've seen with the U.S. Marshals Service, there was a great report. I think it was CoinDesk did an analysis or an investigation that showed just how kind of shoddy the management just within the U.S. Marshals Service was of these assets and spreadsheets and sort of plain text emails being sent with with their addresses in it. It was just kind of messy. So not like confidence inspiring that we've been good stewards of the taxpayers' assets in this respect. So I think it's a very important, cleanup activity that the executive order calls for. So yes, so that's kind of a mixed picture, right? I think at one point we probably had more than we think. I don't know how much remains. I think it's why it's a matter of urgency that we establish a full accounting of that, and I think that's what the executive order does. But there is a scenario that we could wake up, post whatever that deadline is in 2 plus weeks or so. I don't know if they'll make the numbers public, but they might find out they actually have less Bitcoin than they thought, right? When they probably should have had more Bitcoin than they thought, maybe even a few months ago. And meanwhile, if you look at our U.S. Rivals and other countries around the world, might actually turns out they have a lot more than we do, right? So that might provide a bit of urgency to the White House, if they want to be a quote, at least have the largest position in Bitcoin relative to other sovereigns, they're going to have to, there's going to have to be some catch up. And that's where these different mechanisms for budget neutral acquisition come into play. But that's it's an important feature of the executive order that I think didn't get as much attention.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting that the way you put it there, if we're talking about the covert operations the United States runs, it only makes sense that those entities that hold Bitcoin and have been using it have now sold it, right? In advance of this reserve, they're anticipating a full audit, they get rid of it, which would be really unfortunate. So long, provided that this was done before the EO, it's still going to make Trump upset. But the EO clearly establishes that the United States, well, I wrote the law of the land is now buy, hold, and never sell your Bitcoin, which is an incredible thing to say. That said, you talk about budget neutral. A lot of people are getting confused by this. I think this is the main point of ambiguity that you kind of touched on. To some people, it seemed like, okay, the fulfillment of a largely empty campaign promise. He made this thing. He basically just said what we already hold is the strategic Bitcoin reserve. He's never going to do anything about it. And other people are saying, look, this is his way of saying we're going to buy Bitcoin in the future. We're going to do it in such a way that we're not spending any new money to do it. We're keeping it ambiguous because this is our commitment, et cetera. What's your stance on why that phrase was chosen? Do you believe that it was deliberately ambiguous because it's kind of Trump and co lazily fulfilling this campaign promise? Or do you believe that it's a measure taken to kind of ensure that for the American people, this is just a better way of utilizing our funds, right? A better way of deploying the capital we already have deployed kind of across these different places. And another addition to that is was this done so that it wouldn't require congressional approval? Because budget neutral means no new money. No new money means, depending on what we're selling, may not require congressional approval.
Yeah, I think there's both a rhetorical, political kind of objective, and then just like a practical kind of constitutional constraint, which is The first is they clearly don't, you know, they clearly want to be able to say we need to diversify into Bitcoin, this digital asset of the future that has a strategic importance for the U.S. government, but we don't want to do it in a fashion that is going to burden the taxpayer with additional, you know, debt, and you know, just that's a bad headline, right? And so that was objective one. The second is, constitutionally, right, the Congress has the power of the purse, right? They make appropriations to the executive branch, and the executive branch sets the overall strategic, you know, set of policy requirements about, you know, for the national interest, but they have to execute the programs that are funded by Congress at the funding levels that are established by Congress. And of course, there's like lots of like technical marginalia in terms of the Treasury Department, in terms of the ability to issue debt to then get the proceeds, to then finance the programs at the levels that Congress sets the appropriations for. And so that's fundamentally what the limits of executive power are in our constitutional system. If Congress wants to appropriate net new money to fund Bitcoin purchases, that's the function of Congress. And that's obviously what the Bitcoin Act introduced by Senator Lummis and now Congressman Begich in the House is really intended to do, is to sort of codify the appropriations mechanisms and then the long-term statutory anchor for an SBR. But the EO is creating new policy and a new program, and it's using existing assets and resources to fund it. And what's important to note about the executive order is that it instructed both Secretary Lutnick and Secretary Bessent to identify specific means in that budget-neutral fashion of acquiring new Bitcoin. And budget neutral is like, it's not really a technical term, right? Like, it's the only real relevant definition that maybe you can look at is like CBO scoring, right? But the CBO uses like a 10-year window of like, if you do a certain policy or say tax or spending program, the CBO is the Congressional Budget Office, they score new legislation and they have their macro models and they look at like what the effect would be on tax receipts versus overall economic growth, and you know, they do the sort of outlays and receipts sort of analysis over a 10-year period into the future for any proposed piece of legislation. And, you know, if it leads to a net surplus or a net deficit is sort of the question of budget neutral, right? If it leads to a net deficit as measured by those models, then it's not budget neutral per that definition. Now, an executive order doesn't go through CBO scoring, right? It's just an executive order. And CBO isn't going to provide an analysis of any proposal coming out of Commerce or Treasury against that type of framework. And so it's like the only relevant anchor, but it's not really practically relevant to these specific proposals. So then it's kind of, right now it's kind of ambiguous, like operationally what that means and how it will be interpreted by the senior officials at Treasury and Lutnick and the White House, right? It's, you know, for example, you could argue that an asset swap, where you take an existing set of assets on the government's balance sheet that are the government has access to, right? Whether it's it's equity in, say, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, GSEs, right? That are essentially the government's subsidy to certain mortgages, and so they have a whole massive portfolio of mortgages. If they were to privatize those government sponsored enterprise, essentially re-IPO them, the government has essentially the private equity. It sells those into the public, converts those into public equity, and then essentially generates, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of proceeds. Those are new dollars that the government has then generated on its balance sheet as a result of selling up like its private equity asset. Right? Is that considered budget neutral? It's kind of a it's like an open question in my mind. I think some people would argue, well, you are essentially increasing the government's budget by taking this sort of illiquid asset that this is sort of private equity in these government-sponsored enterprises, and by privatizing them, you're creating essentially new money, right, that the government has access to. So that's not budget neutral, right? You're now, it's like a net new injection of budget resources, and then you're making a policy decision to use those new resources to acquire a new asset, in this case, Bitcoin. Others might make the argument that the government's balance sheet hasn't changed, right? It just marked an existing illiquid intangible asset, you know, into a liquid asset, converted that into dollars, and they converted the dollars into Bitcoin. And the government's overall, net position didn't change, right? It just took an existing, illiquid asset, monetized it, and bought Bitcoin with it. And so I think this is less like a legal question and more of like a question of like how different levels of the bureaucracies are going to interpret what budget neutral means, right? And then ultimately it's like how you argue it, right? It's like the government already has the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac assets, so it doesn't have to borrow new money to finance it. So I think about budget neutral really in terms of the incremental net cost to the taxpayer, right? And in terms of what are the mechanisms at the end of the day, does the taxpayer have to foot a further bill to finance these Bitcoin purchases? That's really where the rubber meets the road for me on what that executive order really means. And I think you make the argument that mechanisms like Fannie Freddie privatization don't impose an incremental cost to the taxpayer. Similarly, Exchange Stabilization Fund, which has a net positive position, doesn't impose, you know, has, you know, existing, you know, $39 billion just sitting there in T-bills. Using those essentially cash that's just sitting in the government's checking account to purchase some out of Bitcoin doesn't require any new debt issuance. But again, there's probably bureaucratic arguments inside the Treasury Department. The Exchange Stabilization Fund is like a well-guarded, you know, statutory set of programs to manage our exchange of gold, foreign exchange, sort of COVID emergency programs. It's very much like a new idea to sort of use that for Bitcoin. I think there's a lot of institutional resistance to that. The most, I'd say, low-hanging fruit in terms of budget neutral is just to take existing crypto assets and sell them for Bitcoin.
Because one of the things in the EO was that it imposed on the SBR, you're not going to sell any of this into the future. It did not have that same restriction for the digital asset reserve stockpile. So basically what they're saying is, all right, should we determine that the stuff we hold, like why would we need to hold Tron, you know, a couple billion in Tron that could be sold in the Bitcoin? To me, that's also the most logical thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, there's not that much, though. There's like maybe a few hundred million of total assets. I think Alex Thorne put out a recent accounting. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it's like effectively like 98-99% Bitcoin. So already. So you get like some additional Bitcoin by, you know, selling off the rest of the junk, basically. But it's not necessarily going to like move the needle strategically in terms of the, you know, the SBR. So I think we're in this really interesting moment, but we will find out pretty soon. So the next 2+ weeks-ish, those agencies, Treasury and Commerce, essentially owe get-backs to the White House with their policy proposals, right? So they got to come up with, you know, they got to write their memos. They got to write their you know, 2 to 3 page, whatever policy scorecards of here's our ideas to do this in a budget-neutral way. Someone's got to, you know, look at those and go, yes, no, yes, no. And then figure out operationally the ones they say yes to, how is that going to mechanically work? So there's a lot of like logistical things, right? Like, where is this office going to be stood up? Which custody arrangements are they going to use? Existing custody arrangements, bring in third party custody arrangements. Are they going to issue like an RFI to bring in, you know, third party vendors to bid for that type of service for that new program? And, you know, I did government contracting early in my career, and it's like, that's not quick, right? The government's like, oh, we want to do something new. We have to then create like a competitive process. We've got to do an RFI and then an RFP. We've got to review the proposals and we got to select them. Then we got to onboard the new vendor and then yeah, 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 the security requirements. And then, you know, everything just kind of, you know, this is how things, this is why this is the cruise ship, right? Of like White House or executive order to like, you know, a fully operational SBR that stood up inside, you know, say the Treasury Department. So this might be why the market's kind of trying to understand now, like, well, what's the timeline for when actually, like, you know, a buy order is pressed, right, by somebody acting as an agent of the federal government. And the timeline between Penn being signed, right, Thursday night, and a buy order being pressed is subject to this bureaucratic process, which is, you know, very much kind of opaque to almost everybody, right? It's a political agent or a principal agent dynamic, right, between the White House level folks that are trying to push this at tech speed and the civil servants inside these bureaucracies that, you know, don't necessarily have those same political incentives. I think, again, this is sometimes you're looking at the day to day, week to week. I think it's very important that we get the right ideas, the right structures in place. But I think the clear signal being sent, right, from the captain of the ship is this is the direction we're going. right? And so does the wheel get turned really fast all the way, or is it kind of like deliberate turning, right? This is where we are right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the captain may be shouting the orders at tech speed. You know, the first people who receive that message may be moving at tech speed, but the rest of the boat may be moving at AOL speed. You know, because in the White House, he's decided to hire a bunch of founders, a bunch of, you know, CEOs of multi-billion dollar companies in the case of Cantor Fitzgerald. But it's not the same for everyone else. So we'll certainly see how it pans out and what the timeline looks like. One of the larger areas, you know, just the last question on budget neutral, and then I want to talk about a little bit about the revised Bitcoin Act of 2024, some parts that I think you'll be interested in, is the Exchange Stabilization Fund. One of the larger areas we can pull from for kind of this budget neutral, or I guess more aptly taxpayer neutral, right? So long as it doesn't come, or there isn't really a great phrase for it. So long as it doesn't come at any net new cost to taxpayers, that would be considered budget neutral. But it's the Exchange Stabilization Fund. You've been talking about it for well over a year. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think $39 billion or $40 billion surplus sitting in there. That would equate to, at current prices, something like 480,000 Bitcoin. I may have a zero misplaced there, but that could very well more than triple the United States' current Bitcoin holdings if we take sort of that underutilized money as it is today and deploy it into Bitcoin. Several other things, right? Selling special drawing rights from the IMF. We hold like 160 million, billion in those. And obviously gold certificate revaluation, right? That's the largest area that we can unlock. It's something like $800 billion or $750 billion. So a lot of places to pull from, you know, if in your mind, and I know a lot of the, I know for a fact Sachs & Co. will be looking not only at your work probably, but also looking at the work of the Bitcoin Policy Institute. In your mind, where would be the most logical place to start? Like thinking as someone who's, and obviously this is really going into kind of hypothetical land, but thinking as somebody who's working on these and knows a great deal about these agencies, where do you think they would start?
Well, so right now, basically for the next 2 weeks, they're going to come up with these ideas for the executive order. And that's fundamentally more constrained than what you could do if you're drafting, you know, legislation like you're pointing to for Senator Lummis's bills. But right now, right, like what can you do quickly? What could you do with existing legal authorities? I like the idea of the ESF. I was also told that there's roughly they like to keep about a $20 billion buffer in there as like an emergency, just sort of reserve. So maybe that only leaves $19 billion or so for such purchases. And I think the only obstacle is really kind of an internal bureaucratic obstacle about how those folks that run the ESF interpret the law, right? They interpret the law as establishing a gold reserve, per the Gold Reserve Act, an ESF, where the Treasury Secretary is entitled to deal in gold, foreign exchange, and other instrument of credit and securities. And they read that and they go, I don't see Bitcoin written there, right? Like, period, end, done. And of course, we made the argument in the draft executive order, well, other instrument of credit and securities is quite a broad concept, right? And so you can structure a credit transaction or a securities instrument, depending on how you want to do it, say an overnight note that's denominated in dollars, so it's a dollar credit transaction, where the government's taking overnight settlement risk, essentially, with, say, a counterparty like Coinbase or whoever. And in the morning, they get back Bitcoin, is redeemed in Bitcoin, right? And there it's like, okay, lawyers, right? Lawyers go, nah, no, we're going to be conservative. We don't want to interpret it that way. You know, so we need to amend the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which I think is what you're pointing to in the Lummis Act, which adds a provision where it specifically amends the ESF to put in Bitcoin, right? Along that, in that clause where it says to deal in gold, foreign exchange, comma, Bitcoin, and other instruments of credit securities. Pass that in law. You know, there's no legal argument anymore. It's literally just says Bitcoin explicitly. You know, Treasury Secretary has the ability to do that, right? And this is, we operate in like a highly legalistic system, right? That's formal and bureaucratic and highly structured. And lawyers in these government agencies are, I think, conservative by definition, you know, oftentimes for the right reasons. And so they would rather not get out ahead of their skis or do something too experimental or too novel without a lot of like top cover and, you know, memos being written, right? So that's where the ESF idea kind of, you know, whether it goes that direction or whether it has to get formally codified. And I think the selling of existing crypto assets is like a no-brainer. You know, there's not much, just literally nothing standing in the way of that, other than someone just sort of doing it. The Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac one is, I think, subject more or less to like the legal interpretation of the Gold Reserve Act. It's more of a political determination of, is that considered budget neutral? And then if, I think there is an intention to do the privatization at some point. It could be done quickly, maybe by the summer, we'll see. But then it generates a lot of proceeds for the government, right? The question is, how much then does, can be and should be or will be allocated to Bitcoin? And that's a matter of sort of discretion in that sense. And then there's more mechanisms in the realm of, like, for example, we just designated a bunch of cartels as terrorists, and the U.S. government's not too happy about the fentanyl gangs. And there's a lot of digital assets that are used in those different criminal operations. Well, if the full might of the U.S. government is going to be brought down on top of those gangs, and we generate, as a result, a lot of digital asset proceeds, converting those direct straight into Bitcoin and distributing Bitcoin reserve would be, I think, a good idea as well, right? So there's maybe means of filling up the SBR, but I think fundamentally, right, the executive can only go so far, right? And I think that's, I think, a prudent restraint on the executive that we have in our system. You don't want the executive just to, be able to, do everything that they want and just throw trillions of dollars around, right? Without Congress having a say. So I think you do need to have Congress get in the game here. And so I think it's a very important policy anchor now that the SBR exists, right, per executive order, and maybe, can be incrementally filled up with some clever maneuvers and sound interpretation. But let's be honest, it's not going to be, hundreds of billions of dollars. And so ultimately, this is for it to be a strategic reserve, right? Not just be called a strategic reserve. It actually has to be funded as such by mechanisms established in law. And so that is now where I think, the administrative track is going to continue. And there's a very important activities underway now in the next few weeks and months to actually formally establish the SBR, the different arms and legs of the government, memos and legal opinions, and existing ideas to establish essentially a starter position. That is going to proceed, relatively quickly, right? Depending on how many arms get twisted and quickly memos get signed and approved. But the real kind of next focus for us as BPI, beyond the next few weeks, is going to be on the House and the Senate side. Right, you have to get the political consensus, the political agreement, and then the actual statutory codification. And I think it's if you asked folks even a few weeks ago whether an SBR was plausible or even like 10% likelihood of getting in passed in law by August, I think people would have faded that, right? Like 1% chance or less. Like people would have just been extremely dismissive and extremely skeptical, and probably for right reasons. Of that happening, even as maybe like a week ago, right? And I think rational assessment of the state of play, and it's evolving in real time, even in the last few days, would force you to sort of incrementally revise those estimates upward. I wouldn't say it's like above 50%, right, by any means, but I think it's climbing, right? You're seeing more co-sponsors come on to the Lummis bill. You've seen Nicholas Begich, who is an absolutely boss Bitcoiner from Alaska that every Bitcoiner should follow. He actually had like coins at Mt. Gox.
OG.
That's how OG this guy is. And he's a software developer. He's a super, super nice guy. And he decided to take the bull by the horns and introduce a companion bill, essentially emulating the Bitcoin Act in the House. And then immediately got a whole bunch of co-sponsors. And so now it's a thing, right? When you have a bill that starts getting co-sponsors, right? You start getting momentum. You start getting, this isn't just like one senator's sort of pet project. It's now got legs, and it's you got to build momentum, and then you got to get the White House to provide public support for that. And then we'll see, right? Right now, there had been up until I'd say a week ago, kind of two principal sort of digital asset legislative priorities: the stablecoin bill, or bills, and the market structure push. And I think the legacy, I would say, crypto industrial policy complex had invested a lot of sunk cost and their own social and political capital in those two bills. So they absolutely want to get this across the finish line. And I think those are, you know, depending on how they're structured, I think those are good things to do. You need clarity on market structure definitions, et cetera, and you need to, I think, as a matter of strategic importance, establish fair rules to set up well-regulated stablecoin issuers. But now, SBR is, I think, rising to become like the third leg of that policy stool that is rising to parity, I would say, of priority and importance relative to the other two. I don't think it's taking the lead yet. And I think there's an important complementarity between them in terms of the legislative dynamics. And I think there's going to be a lot more focus now on the practical strategy to get something like the Bitcoin Act passed before the August recess. That was like very, very like shot in the dark a few weeks ago. Now it is okay, this is the game now, right? For example, the reconciliation process. This is getting a bit wonky, but this is what you kind of have to look at, right? Is the Bitcoin Act, you know, essentially is a fiscal maneuver, right? The SBR exists now as a matter of national policy, and it has been called the Byrd Rule, which determines what can be considered, sort of kosher to go through the reconciliation process. Where now you can, now the main difference is you only need 51 votes to pass it instead of 60, right? So getting 60 votes of the Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Act as a standalone bill, or even part of a larger digital asset policy push, would be a pretty high bar to clear, right? Getting that would require getting a large number of Dems to sort of support it. You know, I think it's worth exploring that, and I think it's worth also courting members of the on both sides to push this, because I don't think Bitcoin is inherently partisan. Although of course it gets refracted through our partisan politics like everything else. So I think it's you need to, you know, win allies and educate folks and address their concerns from every perspective. But as a matter of just like tactical, like what is the highest probability path to getting something like the Bitcoin Act passed? It's through the reconciliation process, and that's not it's not a crazy idea to me right now. And so this is where it's like the ground game. This is like where it's like you need good education, you need good analysis. There's a lot of members that, you know, they think of Bitcoin and Fartcoin as like just different names for the same thing, right? So we're in this like interesting world where the United States is sort of signaling to the rest of the world that it thinks about Bitcoin as digital gold and a strategic asset and wants to build a reserve of it, and yet a lot large number of staffers and congressmen and senators, you know, this doesn't they're on like sort of step one, right, in a lot of their knowledge. And so you kind of while you have like the sort of grad school level stuff that I've been talking about, right? You also need to kind of do like the 101 level stuff at the same time. And that's basically BPI's function, right? Is to kind of do both, right? To try to just do like the policymaker education and kind of lay the foundation, as well as try to like advance the frontier. Like where can this really be executed? And what's the strategic implications of this? Because other countries are listening. Right, and they don't have that same sort of democratic process that we go through, right? Like they can just decide once they reach some sort of internal threshold to go. And I am concerned that, you know, the sort of the executive order was a starting gun that was fired. And, you know, we are, I don't know what like the sprinter analogy is to use like metaphors, but we're like, what are those sprinters that has like it, we're like bad off the blocks. Right. But, you know, if we don't trip ourselves, we could probably win the race because we just have like excellent closing speed. Right. Whereas there's a bunch of other sprinters, right, that also jumped off, right, when we were firing the gun, but have maybe faster starting speed. But they maybe have a ceiling in terms of their, you know, how like their top speed. Right. And then it's like at the end of the race, it's like, can we close that? Right. And so this is a really interesting point in time, right? This is kind of a unique moment where it's kind of this that like very beginning of that race, right? And you're looking at like, and you don't see much movement. You don't see really, you know, it's like you took a like 2 milliseconds after the firing gun, right? It's like the race hasn't started, right? You don't see anything, right? But then, you know, things change. Yeah, so this is where I think a lot of the work of BPI is going to be focused is, you know, trying to offer good suggestions on how to execute the executive order in the way that it's intended, and then educate policymakers to make it like a practical, you know, and feasible path to get something like the Bitcoin Act passed.
Phenomenal. Yeah, you know, it's this thing was put together by executive order. It's out there. We fired the starting gun. Because we are a representative republic, now this has to go through this long bureaucratic process in order to actually establish these funding mechanisms, which have to be codified in law, you know, because, you know, depending on what the lawyers will ultimately say, if we decide to go the route of something like structuring a Bitcoin transaction in a credit instrument to acquire more of it, right? Chances are these things need to be codified into law. To make it an actual reserve, we got to establish funding mechanisms for it, just like we have funding mechanisms for our gold reserve. Fantastic stuff. And so in that vein, your main goal at BPI now is Congress and the Senate, right? You're looking at these two acts, one in Congress, one in the, or one in the Senate, one in the House. In your mind, currently, are you enthusiastic about the way things are headed now, especially with this sort of duplicate bill being presented in the House? And, you know, that said, what do you think the likelihood is of one or both of these being passed? And I hate to ask for timelines, but maybe an extremely rough timeline on which, like, some sort of funding mechanism will be codified.
Well, the executive order is subject to the next 2 to 3 weeks of the agencies coming back to the White House with their proposals, the White House reviewing them, deciding which ones they want to endorse and execute on, and then the, you know, the buckets passed back to the agencies to start implementing whatever gets sort of the green light. And that execution process could take a while. I don't know. Like, this is, that's where you have to really get in the weeds of, like, okay, well, selling the digital assets that are in the stockpile, right, probably could be done in a day, right? But setting up like a new office and, say, doing Fannie and Freddie privatization, well, that's going to be many, many months. You know, if it, you know, and there would be a lot of like pitfalls where it might not happen at all. So this is where that is like a large tree of uncertainty. The legislative path, similarly, right? And it's highly nonlinear, right? Like, before we had our forum, there was like no bill in the House, and Lummis had like one co-sponsor, right? Now both bills exist in both houses of Congress, and they have multiple co-sponsors, right? That all happened in like 24, 36 hours.
Well done.
And people's minds are being changed like in real time, right? The president has now sent this very clear signal, right? He's endorsed it, right? That creates a permission structure to lots of other members of Congress to endorse it, but they have to get comfortable with it, right? Like, they're busy people, and like, they got to read this thing. They got to get briefed on it. And, you know, some have really good staffers that understand this stuff. Some don't have really good staffers that don't understand this stuff, or are taking inputs from people that are trying to, you know, undermine the process. And so this is Congress. This is politics, right? And it's nonlinear. And you want to get momentum. You want to get people's concerns addressed. And so, like, Connor Brown, for example, and Senator Lummis' staff is like kind of almost like a unicorn from my perspective, of a guy who can. He's like extremely well versed in Bitcoin, been a Bitcoiner, understands the legislative process, is a good civil servant, and is really good at working with other people, you know, other staffers, other folks across the Senate, including, you know, both sides of the aisle, right? And it's a personal thing. You got to like talk with them. You got to, you know, go through the text. You got to be like, what's the concern with this measure? Is it too big in terms of the total size? Is it too fast in terms of the time frame? Are there additional, you know, provisions that folks want to put in? So this is how this is going to get done. But it's about maintaining that momentum, right? And giving folks like good materials that they can use to understand the issue. So this is me just kind of talking. BPI is like, you know, we're this 501c3 that exists to provide that type of policymaker education. I think it'll be, people just make up percentages, right? Like handicapping these things. Like, I'd say while it was like 1%, now it's like much higher than that, right? And the most important thing is it's rising, right? And so it's more a question of, is there a ceiling, or are we going to hit like a wall somewhere, right? Where it kind of just taps out, right? Where the six or seven folks kind of, that's it, right? or do we get a bit more momentum here? And I think you're going to have hearings coming out in the Senate. So Lummis, who's obviously this is one of her, if not the most important priority for her, she chairs the Digital Assets Subcommittee, so she can help set the agenda and host hearings. So I think having a hearing on the SBR, which I expect sometime soon, maybe the next 3 to 4 weeks or something like that. We'll see, right? Schedules and whatnot. Is going to be a very important measure. Like, that's the policy process. You have the hearing, you have expert witnesses, you have sort of testimony, you've got folks that try to attack it from both angles. And I think having folks there to kind of articulate the strategic value of this, and both the national security side, both the sort of fiscal management side, address the risks, address the concerns, and get folks on board with it, right? It's kind of a novel, it's a relatively novel idea. So I wouldn't expect it to just be like a, all systems go, from Bitcoiners. But I'm now like, I guess I have to be cautiously optimistic, right? That like we can get this through. But if it's passed by August, I mean, man, like that was not priced in. I'll tell you that right now. I'll
No.
tell you, like, a Bitcoin Act being passed before the August recess is like 100% not priced in at all, right? And so I think the market is applying maybe like a, less than 1% probability of that. And I think they should probably price in more like a 10 or 20% probability of that, which is a dramatically higher probability. It's not by anywhere guaranteed, but if you're being rational, you should up your probability for that scenario. The other thing, and this is getting a bit more wonky, is Zoltan Pozsar, right, who doesn't doesn't publish publicly now. He's
Unless you have $30,000 a year or something
sent
like that.
out some notes to his clients, which are, central banks, institutional fund managers, a lot of, movers and shakers about the SBR. And he's very interested in the Bitcoin Act from a kind of a perspective of the mechanism that's in there, right? Which is this revaluation of the gold certificates, which, if you look through history, is a thing the US government has typically relied on when it's doing this sort of generational reset of the system, right? 33 with Roosevelt, post-Bretton Woods system, then the Nixon shock, and you didn't
And right
have.
now we have this extreme public debt situation.
Exactly, right? And so this is where I wrote this whole white paper. We turned it into a book that we published on the global economic reordering and Bitcoin's role. And so now Bitcoin is potentially playing this role as a geopolitical asset, but the mechanism of the Bitcoin Act is very useful to Bessent as a tool now in his toolkit, if it gets passed, that every Treasury Secretary has relied on when executing any kind of monetary reset. If you look through the history of these gold revaluations, they had to be established by law. Like, the statutory gold price, as I said, is statutorily defined at right now $42.22 an ounce. So while maybe some folks, might say, oh, the president can just declare an emergency and revalue gold, and maybe, we have a unit, some folks that believe in sort of the unitary theory of the executive. But with this type of thing, like, you want to be a really solid ground, right? You would not want to have to ha you would not that to You would not have to like have that be unwound in some messy way. You want it to be a clear new statutory basis for that revaluation, which, like, mechanically in the Bitcoin Act, essentially is just a like a ledger, entry, right? It just says the Fed now has to mark this at the market value of gold, which would then be credited into the Treasury General account at the market price of those gold holdings, which is roughly 800 billion if gold goes up, potentially close to $1 trillion of new reserves, right? And from the Treasury's perspective, that's a very useful thing, right? Now, that $1 trillion just is a one-time injection of cash on the government's on the federal government's sort of checking account. It can do a lot with that, right? The Bitcoin Act specifies using those proceeds to fund a purchase program of Bitcoin over 5 years, and it sets a fixed amount of Bitcoin. Now, that could change, right? The purchase program in terms of a fixed amount of Bitcoin could be changed to the fixed dollar amount, right? So there's lots of, room for adjustment there. But the core mechanism of the gold revaluation, isn't right now, like, the I think likely to change. And that mechanism is strategically important for the US government and for Bessent in particular, above and beyond any Bitcoin purchases, right? Because then it allows him to do this gold revaluation. And if you've got $1 trillion in the TGA, right? Well, maybe you don't have to do as many coupon issuances. Maybe things like future debt, like debt ceiling, showdowns aren't as problematic for you. And maybe you can, leverage that in a clever way with sovereign wealth funds, off balance sheet structures to fund domestic industrial investment, etc. And there's a they're focused on 10-year yields, right? And to a certain extent, they're looking for mechanisms that allow them to effectively neuter the Fed as a macro-relevant policy instrument, right? Which has kind of already happened, right? Bessent has sort of said, "Oh, we're controlling the 10-year yield, right? The Fed controls the funds rate, short end, but the strategic stuff is at the long end, and that's where they're focused on, not the stock market, as been made clear to anyone who's watching their 401ks that are Mag 7 weighted. Is that the U.S. government rate, at least up until recently, is very much focused on getting yields down, and they've been sticky, right? Even though they've crashed the equity market relatively, right? Whatever, 10, 12% down in the Nasdaq in a month. Yields haven't come down that much. They've come down to like 4.2. But they have to refinance $7 to $9 trillion in the next year or so, and they certainly don't want to refinance those at high yields. So they have a matter of urgency to bring yields down. Well, again, this is connecting a few different dots, but if you can flush the TGA and you can, basically hold back supply at certain tenors, especially at the long end, well, that's going to have a mechanical effect on yields, likely lower. And if you do have that in combination with privatizations of, say, of Fannie and Freddie, I mean, some really smart people who are like experts in that have told me that could compress mortgage spreads by another, 100 basis points or more. And the whole thing now that like most people are dissatisfied about isn't really the price of eggs, right? It's the price of money, right? For 30-year mortgage bonds, right? Everyone's stuck in their homes that they refinanced, if they were lucky, right, at the lows. But now they're maybe in their starter home, and they're stuck, right? They're not going to want to take on a new mortgage at 6.5 or 7%. But if they can get them 30-year down, then politically that's going to be very useful to them. So these things are all coming together. Obviously, I think this goes into the broader geo macro play with gold, right? Where everyone has, I think, a mechanical interest in devaluing their currencies relative to gold. Both U.S. and China have an interest in that for slightly different reasons. But if that were to happen, right, which is kind of the old standby play, I think on the margin, China would benefit more than us, right? And so for me, like the geopolitical kind of asymmetric complement to that strategy is a revaluation of Bitcoin, right? Essentially devaluing the dollar relative to Bitcoin in that sense, while through stablecoins mechanically structure increased demand for our debt, right? And so you can do this sort of two-level game here where you do a bit of a geoeconomic monetary reset, Plaza Accord 2.0 type of thing, where obviously gold gets recentered as a monetary metal on the margin, right? It's not like a going to a gold standard, but essentially it's being reinserted as a monetary metal, which has been aggressively, demonetized in that role for the past 40 plus years. And through stablecoins, right, you get this synergistic link between increasing the USD BTC price and the expansion of this novel crypto euro dollar balance sheet in the offshore market for dollar units on crypto rails. And those, if they're properly reserved, as say the Genius Act from Hagerty would have, well, they can register and they can get the thumbs up from the U.S. government to then essentially proceed to 10x, right, or more, those balance sheets. And so right now, Tether holds about 2.5% of the short end of the total U.S. Kind of bill market. If you 10x, that's 25%, maybe $1 trillion a year or more. Well, again, that's another thing that like helps the government just like roll its debt, right? Mechanically, lower yields, more balance sheet, more fiscal space, more strategic space, and those are all budget neutral, right? Those are just expanding different balance sheets, right? Monetizing existing assets, revaluing gold certificates, privatization of GSEs, and then putting in place a regulatory environment where now offshore balance sheets can sort of mechanically help the U.S. government fund itself and then expand the dollar system. And so, like, if I look ahead, like, these are the dynamics of the next few, and I say 12 to 24 months that are going to come into play here. And Bitcoin is now, I think, at the center of those conversations. Or maybe not at the
Phenomenal.
center, but it is coming in from the side, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Slowly but surely, and Nick wrote in his new book, phenomenal book, like he, going into the history of the Eurodollar system, talking about London banks, issuing their own dollars, the United States initially being, whoa, whoa, what are you doing? And then saying, okay, this helps us assert US dollar dominance. This is now dubbed, over many years, not officially dubbed the Euro dollar system. It seems what we're experiencing right now, Tether owning 2.5% of the front end. At first, what is this entity doing? And then realizing, wait a minute, this helps entrench US dollar dominance globally. Over several decades, that could be 25% of the front end. Okay, now, in the 1900s, 1800s, 1900s, we got the euro dollar system, right? And now it seems like we're living through the early stages of the emergence of this Bitcoin dollar system, which is, Tether, these kind of being these Bitcoin banks holding a lot of US treasuries, realizing that that is synergistic for the treasury and its funding needs, and then, working with them rather than against them because we have shared interests, and kind of this Bitcoin banking system now becomes a core part of the US dollar system, and the Bitcoin dollar system is born.
Yeah, and Paulo Arduino from Tether, he made his first trip
First
ever
trip, yeah.
to the United States to speak with Jack Mallers at our Bitcoin for America policy summit on Tuesday. And so I think there are shifts taking place that most folks are not aware of that are extremely strategic and that are happening fast. The long tail of those won't necessarily be visible, but you're seeing a recalibration and a realignment of a lot of the incumbent structures of power in the world. You're seeing that, right? And everyone gets caught up in the tizzy of tariffs and yada yada yada. But if you pay attention to like what the reordering, right, is that's underway, it's a very significant reordering. And those geopolitical reorderings are going to have a massive effect on capital flows. And the interesting intersection between when you have a world that's increasingly more contested, borders become much more fraught, and therefore borderless technologies become much more important, right? And I think that is an aspect, folks that are looking at these historical models of, say, Plaza Accords or these Bretton Woods agreements, is that was a world that, borders really, really were important in the sense that they structurally imposed huge amounts of friction and constraints on global capital flows, even personal flows, right? Like, the world could be divided up into very hard clubs and fences, and those clubs and fences could be enforced with inducements and coercive tactics. And you're seeing that trying to be applied again, right? The world is sort of dividing up into different clubs and fences, and the U.S. as the provider of a security zone, a very valuable club, wants to enforce an entry fee, all right, or a user fee for the folks that are members of that security and monetary zone. So we don't want you to just have to, essentially freely take advantage of our security, guarantees, or we have to subsidize essentially the global trading system with our military protection and the U.S. Treasury security, and that results in this kind of dollar dust disease. So we want to kind of rebalance that system, and that now requires sort of, imposition of tariffs in one sense, tech controls, and other folks get a vote. And it turns out the U.S. isn't the hegemonic power it used to be, right? So this is a multipolar system where folks can try to play in the gaps and exploit and play great powers off of each other. And the existence of cross-border digital technologies provides those sorts of powers like increasing leverage, right? And so folks, say, in the Middle East don't have very strong militaries, but have large amounts of capital, and importantly have lots of, I would say, digital network power, right? Because they've heavily invested in these sorts of things, right? They become key members of, say, the BRICS. They've also become key members of the Project Enbridge. They're also major investors in Western venture capital and AI, and they exist in sort of this entrepot hub, intermediating between competing blocs in Eurasia and the great, sort of oceanic powers. And I think it's no coincidence that Binance has a major headquarters there. And the U.S. might have think about this sort of distribution of these new nodes in this network competition, which is mediated on digital rails. And Bitcoin stablecoins are a key feature of that competition. And so I think they're now recognizing how to leverage that, right? But it's in a different environment, right? It's not like this is going to mean that, like, the 1990s hegemonic days are back, right? It just means that the rules are being rewritten. And I think it's a fascinating new era for Bitcoin. It has risks, right, as well as opportunities, right? I think there's a whole new set of questions that are now opened up that I think a lot of Bitcoiners are rightfully cautious about, which is now that states are getting into the Bitcoin game, as a matter of, strategic policy. What does that mean for Bitcoin, Bitcoin development, ossification, the nature of the centers of resistance of mining right now, right, and pool concentration and block tempo, you know, production. And where is this arms race going to go in terms of privacy-preserving technologies on Bitcoin and in Bitcoin? Layer 2, ZK Zarks, other sorts of cryptographic you know, tricks. So this is something I'm very interested in at BPI. I know we talked a lot about the congressional stuff and the White House executive order stuff, the macro geopolitical stuff, but like Bitcoin itself is going to now have to address a number of these very sticky questions in technical development and now these industries like mining are very significant industries, and technology continues to change very radically. And there's lots of other risks, right? Supply chain risks for ASICs, right? Like these are the thing that I find fascinating about Bitcoin and the reason why I decided to do full time, right? BPI stuff is like literally almost every aspect of our current social and technological order, like Bitcoin touches in some way, mm-hmm. like our energy system, AI, our monetary system, financial regulations, civil rights, civil liberties, open source development, human rights, geopolitics, right? Like these are all, you know, kind of, you know, compressed into this, you know, tight ball that we call Bitcoin. And every one of them is highly emotionally charged, you know, strategically charged, and it's changing so quickly, right? And then it's, you know, so it means there's a lot of leverage, right? In terms of if you can steer the future trajectory in a positive direction, I think that's, you know, right now is the moment to kind of pull that lever.
Phenomenal. Yeah, you're certainly, you know, capitalizing on the moment. You at BPI and you're working it of yourself. You've created this opportunity and now you're playing a key role in it and diving headlong into it. So I commend you for your work, and I also commend BPI for their work as well. You've been extremely generous with your time, Matt. Before we go, do you have any parting thoughts that you want to leave with viewers about how they should think about the next, you know, 12 to, you know, 40 months, 44 months for the remainder of you know, this year and then the rest of the Trump admin?
I would say I'll take off my analyst hat and put on my, like, you know, influencer podcast bro hat, right? And give like the quip. And actually, David Zale we did a little after dinner, you know, celebrating the people at BPI that, you know, pulled this off kind of unprecedented fashion. And it was like a white pill on human agency, right? Everyone follows the news and reacts to the news and tries to predict and forecast events. And you want to be an analyst and you want to understand. And those are very valuable, you know, dispositions and stances and very important, right? But I think folks sometimes undervalue like agency, right? Getting in the game, right? Not just watching the game. And most folks don't think that you can do that. And it turns out you can, and it's not that hard, right? You just have to think you can do it and have the right approach to executing on that plan. And I think that's what BPI basically did, is like, you can do this thing. Like, the government is porous. Most folks have like a pretty, you know, relatively uninformed view of Bitcoin. And if you just like a laser focus, just like put all of your weight on a particular, you know, sort of part of the Archimedean beam, you can move things, right? I think that was the demonstration of the last 6 months. Obviously, David Bailey, I think, is a more acute personification of that almost metaphysical thesis, that like will, individual will and like agency and like belief and execution, competence mixed with confidence is a toxic power, right? To drive things, right? Like you can really do things in the world. So that's maybe the last thing I'll leave it with, is you can just do things, right? and one of the things you can do is you can support BPI and you can come to our future events. And so we are going to be hosting like our regular, you know, big annual policy summit now, the third annual policy summit in DC on June 25th. So we'll be, you know, doing a lot more kind of public announcements around that now that we're sort of after this this crazy thing that we decided to put on our plates. But that's going to be a much larger event, and the one on Tuesday was kind of much more invitational, and we had thousands of applications. We were able to get about 150 plus people in there. So yeah, follow that, look for announcements for that, apply to join when we put the links out for June 25th in DC. And then another shout out. So we're happy to be partnering with PubKey on opening up essentially a Bitcoin embassy, you could call it, in DC. where we'll have like a large office space for BPI as well as an event space to host regular activities to bring DC to Bitcoin and Bitcoin to DC. PubKey will have their bar as well as a restaurant there. And of course, timeline is subject to DC sort of permits, but hopefully sometime over the summer, we'll be able to kind of do a soft launch. And then I think from then on, right, we're sort of planting the flag, right, downtown, kind of equidistant between the White House and Congress. And, you know, everyone's focused on the next 3 months, 6 months. And certainly there's a legislative window that's open between now and the midterms where, you know, there's a, you know, one party control of all branches of government. So if you want to get major legislation passed, it has to happen essentially in the next 12 months. But I think this is a new era for Bitcoin in America and around the world. And I think we want to establish BPI as an institution, right? Not just as sort of chasing the tactical wins, but turning those into kind of a strategic shift in the United States, but that has cascading impacts around the world. And ideally we can grow BPI into like an institution that is proportionate to Bitcoin in its significance, right? And so, you know, my play is like, if Bitcoin's got a 10x, BPI needs to 50x. You know, not necessarily in terms of budget, but in terms of impact and enduring force. So yeah, I think this is a, you know, if BPI was a shit coin, right? This would be a pretty early stage opportunity. So I'm really excited to get involved and help. Help drive it to its next era. So yeah, follow us at btcpolicy.org, follow the Twitter handle, follow the YouTube accounts. Zach Cohen is our absolute master of all of our socials and analysts, and he's helped grow things on our socials, and so we're really excited, man. It's just the vibes are good, and keep chugging.
Absolutely. Yeah, support BPI and all that they do. Check out their Twitter. It'll be in the show notes. Matt Pines, thank you so much for coming on. Your Twitter will also be in the show notes so people can give you a follow. You are a master at connecting the web of a million different things that nobody sees a connection, but you do. So truly, truly one of a kind mind for our era. And it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you again. And yeah, reminder to everyone who's watching the show, you can just do things. So
yeah, go do them.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thanks a lot for coming on, man. Talk soon.
Thanks, man.